Welcome to ID the Future, a podcast about intelligent design and evolution.
Welcome to ID the Future, a podcast of the Discovery Institute's Center for Science and Culture. I'm David Bowes, your host. In the year 2000, Dr. Jonathan Wells published a review of biology textbooks in their treatment of the icons of evolution. Now, the Discovery Institute's Center for Science and Culture has updated that study, taking a look at 22 recent biology textbooks and their selected use of icons of evolution. And here to talk about it with me, Casey Luskin of the Discovery Institute. Casey, you've got the new report out that deals with a new evaluation of not only the old icons, but a couple of new ones. First, why don't we go over the original and Jonathan Wells' work and remind people of what that was all about?
Sure. Well, many ID the Future listeners have probably read Jonathan Wells' 2000 book, Icons of Evolution. And in an appendix to that book, Dr. Wells did an analysis of textbooks that had been published around that time and how they treated the icons of evolution. And what he did was he created grading criteria to sort of ask how well did the textbooks treat the icons, and he graded them according to sort of your standard scale. You'll have an A, B, C, D, and F. So then he went through these textbooks, looked at how they treated the icons, and they didn't do very well. There were a lot of D's and F's, a couple passing grades, but for the most part, the textbooks did pretty badly in the year 2000 as regarding how they treated the icons. We wanted to do an updated textbook review that looked at textbooks that have been published in the last few years using Jonathan Wells' same criteria that he used in the 2000 textbook review.
In the criteria, for people listening who might not have read Icons of Evolution, what was wrong with them? Why did they get the F's? And what kinds of icons are we talking about here?
Sure. Well, the icons are probably familiar to a lot of folks, even if they haven't read the book Icons of Evolution. They're things like Haeckel's embryo drawings, or Darwin's finches, or the peppered moth, or the tree of life, or the Miller-Urey experiment. Those are just a few of them. The standard common lines of evidence that we see in biology textbooks that are used to support evolution. And what Jonathan Wells found, and he documented this with extensive references to the mainstream technical literature, is that the way that textbooks treat these lines of evidence is inaccurate. They often will make inaccurate claims about the evidence. Let me give you a quick example. The first icon that Jonathan Wells deals with is the Miller-Urey experiment, which is this experiment that took place in the 1950s, which supposedly produced amino acids and other building blocks of life through an experiment that simulated early Earth conditions. It's now really well known that that experiment did not simulate early Earth conditions. Basically, Stanley Miller used gases in his experiment that are now known to not have been present on the early Earth. So the experiment's an interesting sort of chemistry lab, experiment, but it doesn't have any relevance to actual conditions that might have existed on the early Earth. So why is it still in textbooks all over the place as if it shows that the building blocks of life could have been produced on the primordial Earth? Well, it shouldn't be. I mean, you can talk about this experiment, but if you're going to do that, you should be giving students full disclosure that, okay, this experiment and its relevance has sort of been overturned by later discoveries. So Jonathan Wells, he went through the textbooks and said, how accurate are they? Are they giving students full disclosure about the evidence, or are they giving them this dumbed-down version of the story, which claims that all the evidence lines up in support of materialism and Darwinian evolution?
Well, there was a similar thing with the embryo drawings, the Haeckel embryos, and how the drawings do not actually represent, and Jonathan Wells put this in his book, how the drawings do not actually represent what these early stages actually look like. And there's no disputing that. I mean, we have a greater scientific ability to actually see embryos these days. And so there's no disputing the fact that they got this wrong. What was the response of the Darwinian evolutionists who saw this review? Were they challenging the facts presented by Jonathan Wells? Did they react as though these things needed correction? What was the reaction?
You know, there has been some effort to clean up the textbooks and take Haeckel's embryo drawings out. But the response from the Darwin lobby to the fact that these really inaccurate and even fraudulent drawings are being used in textbooks has been really quite amusing. We've seen responses ranging from, on the one hand, that drawings are inaccurate and they should not be used, to they were inaccurate and they should be used, to they were inaccurate and never used to they are accurate and they should be used. So, you know, we've really seen them struggling almost in an incoherent manner to deal with the fact that, I mean, there's really compelling, strong evidence that these embryo drawings overstate the degree of similarity between embryos in their earliest stages. And I think that the Darwin lobby has very badly struggled to cope with the fact that textbooks are misrepresenting this fact to students. However, one of the good pieces of news is that our 2011 textbook review found that fewer textbooks are now using Heckel's embryo drawings than they were in the past. It's still not perfect. There are still textbooks that use Heckel's drawings, but things are better than they used to be. It's really one of the few, if not the only, bright spots that we found in our textbook review. And don't get me wrong, things are still really bad. They're now using photographs and making inaccurate claims instead of drawings and making inaccurate claims. So there's only a slight improvement even there.
Well, that brings me to the follow-up. First of all, I think it's really telling that when someone shows you that the evidence is wrong, instead of working to correct it, you attack the messenger. Or you justify it and say, well, okay, even though these drawings are misleading, we think it's okay because the artistic representations bring the students' minds to the point to where we wanted them to be. But if it's presented as evidence, as a reality, and it's not, then that's just misleading students and manipulating them to come to conclusions that you have. And so when confronted with this evidence in the year 2000 from Jonathan Wells, now you've gone back, you've looked at all the previous icons, and you've mentioned a couple, and a couple of new ones. Why don't we first describe what the new icons are before we get into how you evaluated them?
Yeah, that's right. We decided to add two new icons in our 2011 review because textbooks have changed over the last 10 or 11 years. And today we're seeing that the icon of junk DNA has become very common in textbooks, as well as the icon of whale evolution. It's claimed that there is this series of fossils which supposedly demonstrates how whales evolved from primitive little land mammals, something kind of like a mouse deer, over the course of about a 10 million year period. So these, again, are very common icons today, and they have been heavily critiqued also by Darwin skeptics. And so we thought that it was worth investigating whether textbooks are promoting these icons as sort of unwashed evidence that unambiguously supports evolution, or are they actually letting students critically analyze the arguments for and against evolution on these icons?
And you found out, let's start with those icons that were covered in Jonathan Wells' 2000 work. The evidence was presented, and new research has shown that these things were being used falsely. Have the textbooks corrected any of the previous icons?
Well, like I said, one of the few areas where there actually was a little bit of improvement was Heckel's embryos. Instead of using fraudulent drawings to claim that early vertebrate embryos are similar in their earliest stages, now they're using photographs to inaccurately claim that vertebrate embryos are similar in their earliest stages. So the point they're making is still wrong. They're still overstating the degree of similarity between vertebrate embryos in their earliest stages. However, at least now they're using photographs, which it's harder to basically fudge than Heckel-like drawings.
Well, how do you mean that the photographs are being used misleadingly? How does that happen?
Well, what you'll see is you'll see photographs of embryos, and the photographs often sometimes actually show distinct differences between embryos. However, the text then says something completely different. The text will then say something like this: vertebrate embryos are highly similar in their earliest stages, and this provides evidence that the organisms share a common ancestor. Now, of course, when you look at actual embryology, and there's a lot of evidence to back this up, in their earliest stages, vertebrate embryos are actually quite different. They're not similar. So you sort of have the pictures telling one story, and then you have the text telling a different story. Hopefully students will be able to spot the disconnect there, that the pictures don't support what's being claimed in the text. But a lot of students probably aren't going to do that. And truthfully, the textbooks are still inaccurate on this point.
So it's a bit of a sleight of hand. Now, you mentioned that the embryo drawings are the best in terms of how they've been dealt with since the year 2000. What was the second best, or were they all equally bad?
This was, frankly, the only other area where there was improvement, and it was still very slight, was in the treatment of Darwin's Tree of Life. One of the criteria that Jonathan Wells used for the Tree of Life icon was whether the textbooks mentioned the Cambrian explosion, which, as many of our listeners know, is an event that took place about 530 million years ago, where nearly all of the major animal phyla appear in the fossil record without clear evolutionary precursors. And a lot of textbooks in Jonathan Wells' 2000 review basically completely omitted any mention of the Cambrian explosion. In the 2011 review, we found that a lot more textbooks, they are now mentioning the Cambrian explosion, which is good. I mean, that's an improvement. This is perhaps one of the most important events in the history of animal life. However, textbooks are still painting universal common descent as unadulterated fact, and they never present students with any evidence that might challenge universal common descent. So what this did is it moved these textbooks from receiving an F on the icon of the Tree of Life to a D. And that's the way Jonathan Wells' grading criteria worked. If they mention the Cambrian explosion and they treat Tree of Life as an unadulterated fact, they get a D. If they don't even mention the Cambrian explosion, they get an F. So again, we see a slight improvement there. And I have to be honest with you, these two icons, the Tree of Life and Haeckel's embryos, were really the only areas where we saw any improvement that was non-negligible. In some embryos, we saw things got worse, such as in homology, invertebrate limbs, and Archaeopteryx. Textbooks actually got worse in how they deal with those topics.
How does a textbook get worse from an F?
Well, actually, in Jonathan Wells' 2000 review, there were a number of textbooks that didn't get Fs on homology and vertebrate limbs, whereas now there's quite a few that did get Fs. That's basically what happened. They got Ds, and they went from a D to an F. You have to understand that when we're talking about improvement or, I guess, worsening, we're talking about did you get a D or an F. No textbook, none of the icons, had an average grade that was higher than a D. They were all at a D or lower. So we're talking about, were you at the very bottom of the barrel or almost at the bottom of the barrel? There's really very little cause for celebration here when we're looking at the way biology textbooks treat evolution.
But what was it that knocked the homology and vertebrate limbs, the use of that icon, down? What moved them from D to F there?
I think in that one it came down to, were they making a circular argument for homology and common descent? Basically, what happens is textbooks will define homology as the result of common descent, and then they will use homology as evidence for common descent. So it's kind of a circular argument that's being made there for common descent. And there are a number of evolutionary scientists over the years who have expressed concern that homology really cannot be used as evidence for common descent. You can't have it both ways, basically. It can't be resulting from common descent and then also evidence for common descent. You're arguing in a circle if you talk like that. So I think that we're seeing, unfortunately, more and more textbooks are dumbing down their treatment of homology and arguing for evolution in this circular fashion.
So the new icons, the whales and the junk DNA, I take it that they were found commonly throughout the various textbooks, the 22 recent biology textbooks that you studied in this new update.
Yeah, they were. As far as whales, they were found in, I think, 15 of the 22 textbooks. And here the textbooks did pretty bad. They all received either Ds or Fs. I think that there were 8 Ds and 7 Fs, which means basically the textbooks are presenting this line of fossils as if they show true evolutionary transitions from land mammals to whales. I believe that if they mention the fact that this transitional series happened very rapidly, they got a D. If they didn't even mention the time scale, then they got an F. And the reason why the time scale is relevant is because, as Discovery Institute fellow Richard Sternberg has argued, the evolution of whales from the fossil record happened so quickly, 10 million years or less, which might sound like a long time, but when you think about all of the anatomical changes that would need to take place to go from a land mammal to a whale, you actually would need far, far longer than 10 million years to affect all of those changes using Darwinian evolution. So bottom line is that the fossil record requires too much change too quickly when you look at the so-called transition from land mammals to whales. None of the textbooks acknowledge this problem. Some of them at least acknowledge the rapid evolutionary timescale, but they did not frame it as if it actually might pose a challenge to unguided Darwinian evolution by natural selection and random mutation. So that was basically the problem with the whale series. With junk DNA, we saw, I think, a few less textbooks that used it. Here we did find a few textbooks that actually got a passing grade of a C. And in these cases, the textbooks mentioned that there is evidence of function for junk DNA. However, I think only 4 out of the 22 textbooks that we surveyed actually did that. Most of the textbooks that use junk DNA didn't even give any hint that we're discovering function for junk DNA, and some of them used that alleged lack of function as an argument for evolution. So junk DNA was actually not as bad as I was expecting it to be, but it still has a lot of room for improvement.
It sounds like frequently the problem is people not being willing to say, I don't know. For example, with the 10 million years it takes to get a land mammal to a sea-going whale, instead of just saying, we don't know how that works, they're asserting this is fact. And same thing with the Cambrian explosion, saying, well, there's a Cambrian explosion, there's an explosion of life, but they don't want to deal with the questions that that leaves unanswered.
Yeah, I mean, you have to understand something here, that every single one of the textbooks we surveyed treats Darwinian evolution in a pro-Darwin-only dogmatic fashion. And this is really what's unfortunate, is that the textbooks are systematically dumbing down the arguments for evolution. They're only giving students part of the evidence. And even when they're talking about things like the Cambrian explosion or the short timeline for whale evolution or the fact that junk DNA has function, they're never providing students with sort of an analysis that might lead you to challenge Darwinian theory or to think outside of the Darwinian box. So they're always framing everything in sort of a dumbed down fashion that only presents one side of the issue. So on every one of these icons, the students are getting the pro-evolution view only. And so that's what you should just come to expect here, is that you're never going to get any evidence against Darwinian evolution in these textbooks. They have an agenda, and they're going to stick to it, and they're not going to let the facts get in the way of that.
Yeah, in the report, you mentioned that one of the textbooks contains a guide to critical thinking, which encourages students to ask certain questions like, are there other ways to interpret the evidence? What other evidence would help me evaluate the alternatives? But then they thwart the students from actually following through and questioning anything about the Darwinian theory.
Yeah, that's right. And it isn't just one of the textbooks, David. It's actually quite a few that have what I would call faux critical thinking exercises. And this is where you're kind of asking students, or at least pretending to ask students, to engage in critical thinking. But then the question only allows you to think in one direction. Let me give you an example. This is from Prentice Hall's 2009 Biology Life Science Explorer textbook. And they have a passage that says, identify supporting evidence. Evidence consists of facts that can be confirmed by testing or observation. As you read, identify the evidence that supports the theory of evolution. Okay, fine. So the students are supposed to identify the evidence that supports the theory of evolution. Well, what about if you're really going to do critical thinking, asking them to identify also perhaps evidence that does not support the theory of evolution? Well, the textbook never does that. It never even provides any evidence that challenges Darwinian evolution for them to think about. Another great example is the 2006 edition of Glencoe's Biology, the Dynamics of Life. And this textbook is rare in that it actually asks students to look at the quote-unquote strengths and weaknesses of the evidence. However, when the textbook only presents a pro-Darwin view, how are students supposed to look at the weaknesses when there are none that are actually even mentioned in the textbook? So, you know, I call these faux critical thinking exercises because they give you the air of critical thinking, but they don't really allow you to engage in critical thinking. There are even some questions in the textbook that require students to pick answer choices that demand assent to evolution. In other words, if the student wants to get the points and wants to get the answer right and improve their grade, they have to answer the question in a way that requires them to assent that they agree with Darwinian evolution. And I think that's really unfortunate because it does not allow students to frame their own opinions and really have freedom of thought.
So if you omit certain information and then you ask students to evaluate, what you've really done is force them to evaluate in the affirmative, because there's no way that they would know what they don't know, which is kind of a clever way of going about things. And you point out that Darwin himself in The Origin of the Species stated that a fair result can only be obtained by fully stating and balancing the facts and arguments on both sides of each question. And that's where the textbooks failed the most, ironically.
Oh, yeah, they don't present both sides of each question. They present one side. It would be like, you know, asking a jury to go and render a verdict after they only heard the prosecution side of the case. Well, guess what answer they're going to give you? It's pretty obvious. They've censored, essentially, and I don't use the word censor by mistake or unintentionally. They are censoring from students the scientific evidence that challenges Darwinian evolution.
Casey, as always, great to hear your voice on ID the Future. If you'd like to download the entire report, go to evolutionnews.org. That's evolutionnews.org. This is David Bowes, your host. I hope you've enjoyed this edition of ID the Future, a podcast by the Discovery Institute's Center for Science and Culture. For more information and to support the Discovery Institute, go to discovery.org/CSC.
This program was recorded by Discovery Institute's Center for Science and Culture. ID the Future is copyright Discovery Institute 2010. For more information, visit www.intelligentdesign.org or www.idthefuture.com.